Welcome to the Bill Barnwell Show. I'm Bill Barnwell, ESPN. We are here on Monday. It is April 22nd, 2019. We are 3 days away from the NFL draft. It is already here. It feels like the season just ended, but it is already draft time. 3 days to go before the first round of the NFL draft. We are having a draft preview show today. We're going to get to the numbers a little later on with Bill Connolly of SB Nation. Joining us first, though, talk about the tape and talk about one of the teams he covers quite closely for The Athletic, a team that has been in the news recently, the Oakland Raiders, of course. That is The Athletic's Ted Wynn. Ted, how are you?
I'm good. I don't know if it's just the coffee or your intro music blasting in my ears, but I'm awake now. I'm ready to go.
We got you hyped. Hyped for this podcast segment about the NFL draft and about the Oakland Raiders, who a very interesting tweet this weekend from NFL Network's Ian Rapoport, who tweeted that scouts were being sent home from the Oakland facility because head coach John Gruden and general manager Mike Mayock didn't know who they could trust when it came to their draft board, didn't want to show their scouts the draft board. So let's just start with this. Is that a big deal to you, or is that just much ado about nothing?
I think that there is something to the story. I mean, the past couple of years, there have been a lot of leaks when it came to the Raiders. I mean, Jason Lockefora came out with a story before the draft about their interest in Colton Miller, and that kind of came out of left field. Nobody really expected it, and they ended up drafting Colton Miller. And just throughout the draft process, there's been things. And then when the story came out, Ian Rapoport got that story right away, and then he even knew that the scouts were on the way on a bus to the airport. So somebody is dissatisfied and leaking out information. Mm-hmm. And Daniel Jeremiah talked about this, and I've heard it from other scouts. It's common practice for the team to hide their board from their scouts in case of leaks and that kind of thing. So I don't think it's very uncommon, but I do think there is something there.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, I've heard from people in the league when that tweet came out, I heard people saying, it's not a big deal. You know, like, there are teams who don't want to show their scouts, and that makes sense. But the trust element of it, I think, is interesting. And very commonly, when it comes to this time of year, when you have a organization that's made a change, in this case, you know, bringing in Mayock, they of course, went off and Reggie Williams last year, or Reggie McKenzie, excuse me, last year, you have scouts who get fired, who end up going to different places, who, you know, guys want to bring in their own guys, and typically that means the scouts from the old regime, or some of the scouts from the old regime, do move on. So it wouldn't shock me if some of those scouts were not coming back for next year. And so this could be sort of a pretense to that, but the trust wording seems strange. And I don't think that it's a – I think it's somewhere between those two extremes that I laid out. And I don't know – I don't get the sense that there's something crazy happening with the Raiders. I don't know about you. I mean, do you think there's something that they're going to do or they're thinking about doing that is really dramatically different from – you know, what we've sort of heard about up to this point about what the Raiders are thinking?
I think with John Gruden at the helm, anything is possible. So I'm prepared. Like right now, I'm just in a mode where I'm prepared for anything. And if anything happens, I wouldn't be surprised. And I think part of having ultimate secrecy is that maybe that they are posturing for a move and mm-hmm. they don't want anybody to know about it. So it's definitely a possibility, and just having three first-round draft picks and having this draft be so pivotal, I can understand why they have such a strong, I guess, paranoia about their draft board.
From your perspective, as someone who watches the team, but someone who also, you know, thinks about the league from the broader perspective, what is your appetite, just on your own end, for them doing something that they don't expect? Would you trust them more if they had a strong feeling about a guy and they did make a move at four, or they traded up or traded down or did something that we weren't expecting for a player who we haven't seen popularly linked to them? Or would you feel better if they just sort of stayed put and just took either Kyler Murray, Quinnen Williams, Josh Allen, or Nick Bosa, who have been sort of the top four picks for most of this draft cycle, with the fourth selection order was left out of those four guys?
I really don't know, because I mean, with Mayock, this is going to be his first draft ever, mm-hmm. so it's hard to trust him, you know, because he doesn't have a track record. Right. And Gruden, has a bit of a track record in Tampa Bay, but this is kind of a new era for him. Mm-hmm. Last year's draft wasn't that bad. I mean, they passed on Derwin James, which is probably the worst. But Arden Key, Mo Hurst, even Colton Miller showed mm-hmm. that they might have some ability to be good players. So mm-hmm. There's just a lot of unknown with the Raiders right now. So it's hard to say that I would trust him. But it would seem like, you know, with the high picks that they do have, that it probably would be better to just stand put unless they get like a huge offer from another team.
Mm-hmm. So just in terms of those picks, 4, 24, and 27, I believe, if they don't trade up, they don't trade down, they don't trade for a veteran, they don't move anywhere, if they stay put, given the range of sort of where guys are likely to fall, what would be your dream sort of three players to grab from those picks?
Well, if Quinn Williams to me is the best player in this draft, I mm-hmm. think there's a realistic chance that he does fall down to number 4, especially yeah. if the Jets draft Josh Allen, which seems likely because that's such a big need for them and he just fits their scheme. So if Quinn Williams goes down to 4, the Raiders have a bit of a logjam at defensive tackle, but he's just the best player available by far at that spot. Pairing him with Mo Hurst would be awesome. Mm-hmm. The Raiders also have a need at tight end, so I think if Hockenson or Fant drops down to 24, I think mm-hmm. Hockenson will probably be gone by then, but I think yeah. there's a realistic chance Fant will be there at 24. You pick up him, and the Raiders need an edge rusher. So if Colin Farrell or Chase Winovich are the guy that I'm higher on than most people, mm-hmm. I think if either of those two guys are down there at 27 and the Raiders pick edge rusher at that spot, I think that would be an ideal first round for them.
Yeah, I mean, that's hitting three key spots for them. And I think, obviously, you know, on the defensive side of the ball, it's really more about adding talent, I think, than hitting any specific position. But given how low they were in terms of their sack total last year, you would figure that makes sense to go after, you know, two defensive linemen, one edge rusher, one interior disruptor, and Quinn Williams would be great for the Raiders. All right, Ted, well, let's talk about some of the key players in this year's draft and the Niners, who you also cover for The Athletic, in a moment. But first, we need to talk about our friends at SeatGeek. And yes, for the third consecutive week in a row now, maybe the fourth consecutive week in a row, no exaggeration, if you saw my Twitter this week, you saw I was in Raleigh, North Carolina. I went and watched the Washington Capitals lose to the Carolina Hurricanes in one of the loudest arenas I have ever been in my entire life. It was a last-second decision. And why did I go? Well, I went to go see the Capitals. They lost. That happens. Not the best situation, but had a good time, got a great seat, got a great deal. And I got tickets at the last second because I used our friends at SeatGeek, because you don't have to get tickets for SeatGeek weeks in advance. You don't have to know when tickets are going to go on sale. You don't have to be a season ticket holder. You can just get tickets when you need them for whatever game or concert or Broadway play or whatever you want that involves tickets. You can just go to SeatGeek and get those tickets. And I'm not going to lie, I would have been very upset if I had driven all the way to Raleigh, North Carolina from Washington, D.C. Not that long, 4 hours or so. But if I had driven that long for tickets that were inauthentic or did not work, I would have been seriously bummed. But I was not worried about that because SeatGeek guarantees every purchase. So I shop with confidence. I walked in with confidence, and then the Capitals lost, and I walked out without confidence. But I enjoyed my tickets with SeatGeek. And sadly, because I use SeatGeek so frequently, I did not get $10 off my first purchase. But if you haven't used SeatGeek before, you can. Just go to the SeatGeek app or go to SeatGeek.com and use our promo code, which is Barnwell, my last name, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L. Use promo code Barnwell and get $10 off your first purchase for concert tickets, sports, comedy, whatever you want. SeatGeek supports the show, so please support SeatGeek by using promo code Barnwell and getting $10 off your first purchase at SeatGeek today. Now back to the show. Guy who's come up over the past couple of days, actually, really interesting positives and negatives when you hear about what's happening to guys at the top of the NFL draft is Ed Oliver, who a couple of days ago we had one anonymous scout complaining to Bob McGinn, longtime reporter in Wisconsin, that quote-unquote, running his mouth will get him in trouble somewhere. I would doubt he'd have any loyalty to his team when he becomes a player, which is interesting. And then over the past 24 hours, Peter King's column today, suggestions that the Jets were very interested in Ed Oliver with the third pick, and then a report earlier today that the Raiders are interested in Ed Oliver possibly with the fourth pick. Where do you think Ed Oliver should land, given what you've seen from him?
To me, Ed Oliver is a top five player as mm-hmm. far as athleticism. There is a bit of a rejection with him just because he was used so strangely in Houston, and he's just not a prototypical three tech just because of his size. He gained weight, but I don't know if that's going to be his playing weight. But I do believe he's a top five player, and I like him in a scheme where they move him around more instead of just putting him at three tech. I think with the Jets, that is a possibility. I think that their scheme, I believe they run the 3-4 scheme there, and they have the ability to move him around a little bit. So I think if the Jets pick him up, that'd be a good spot for him, and Williams would drop down to 4 for the Raiders, so that'd be nice.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. That'd be 2 interior linemen then. Of course, like you said, you know, Oliver's going to move around, but, you know, 2 defensive tackles primarily in the top 4, which would be really interesting. And then Josh Allen, dropping out of the top 4, you would assume that would possibly be, in line for some of those teams to move up and maybe get an edge rusher that thought wasn't going to be there, later in the top 10. In terms of the prospects you've analyzed for The Athletic over the past few weeks, you've written about Kyler Murray, Devin Bush, and Hollywood Brown. What did you find in watching them closely that sort of might be at odds with our popular opinions and sort of our perceptions about those players if you haven't gone into the tape quite as deeply as you did?
I think that there is a perception that Kyler Murray is just an athlete, and that's why the NFL is as obsessed with him because of his athletic ability. But I think if you watch the film, he shows a lot of football IQ. And in the article I wrote, I sat down with Dan Orlowski and Joe Klatt, 2 former quarterbacks, and we just looked at a few plays that displayed Murray's football IQ. He's really good at beating the blitz, IDing the blitz, and finding his hot receiver, which is going to be big in NFL, especially for a young quarterback that defensive coordinators want to blitz a lot. It also shows that he has a high mental ceiling and that he can learn more, and he's more than an athlete. So with Kyler Murray, I think that the intrigue is more than just his athleticism. With Devin Bush, linebacker from Michigan, I actually like him better than Devin White from LSU. I think, a lot of people have White as their number one linebacker, but with White, when blockers get their hands on him, he really struggles. Like, he gets pushed back far, and that's not as big of a deal in the NFL today just because of all the spread and the speed you need at the linebacker position. But with Devin Bush, he has similar speed. They both ran 4.4s, which are just ridiculous for linebackers. White is faster. On tape, he's faster. But Bush has the power to take on blocks, and he has kind of his bulldog mentality that I really like. So to me, Bush is a little bit higher than White, although it's not by much. And with Hollywood Brown, when you watch the tape, you could tell that he's just a very mature route runner. Wise beyond his years, he does all these little things that you see really good NFL wide receivers do. So just sitting down with him, I wasn't surprised at how smart he was, but he actually taught me a few things that I didn't know. So I was really pleasantly surprised after I came out of that film room with him. So if that foot injury is good, and obviously his size is going to be a concern still, even if he's healthy, I just wouldn't be surprised if Hollywood Brown's a big-time player.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of that wide receiver class, is he your number one wideout?
I had Hakeem Butler as my number one for a while now. And I just think, to me, the foot injury is still a concern for me. I'm not a doctor, but just in my mind, it just seems like something that won't heal right away. So, and his size is still a concern. So he's my number two receiver.
Are you, you read a lot about how teams are maybe a little concerned about scouting wide receivers. You've had some, big busts in recent years. Hasn't been that sort of great wide receiver crop, and there's been exceptions, of course, but, there were a few years between, 2010 and 2017 where there were some really, really highly drafted wideouts who did not turn out to be very much. Do you find any real concern in terms of evaluating those guys from a pro perspective, or is it just that we just happen to have a few, bad drafts in a row or a couple bad prospects at the top?
Well, I think the wide receiver position is kind of like, is sort of similar to the quarterback position, where football IQ matters for wide receivers because there's all these adjustments and little things that change from play to play that a receiver has to be able to mentally process. And I think that People look at the physical traits a little too much when it comes to wide receivers, and football IQ is a tough thing to judge. And obviously, that's why you see all these quarterbacks bust and all this, you know, the volatility when drafting quarterbacks. I think football IQ is something that isn't looked at as closely at the wide receiver position that needs to be evaluated more closely.
Yeah, I think that makes total sense. I think there's just sort of the reality of, like, you know, you're going to eventually stumble on that guy who just is a size and speed monster, who does develop into a great wide receiver with the right coaching. But I think more often than not, I mean, you can't coach that stuff, and that stuff is going to translate even if the game's being played at a faster speed.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, yeah, just mental processing for receivers, just a big part of the game that isn't talked about a lot, I don't think, from at least looking at it from a media perspective. I don't see it talked about enough.
Well, I mean, I know from my perspective, it's a lot easier for me to judge height and weight and speed than it is to judge football IQ, unfortunately. I think that comes to someone with your level of expertise. In terms of the Devin White and Devin Bush situation, you mentioned that you have Bush number one, but you kind of have them both in the same tier, you know, both really talented linebackers. Would you be comfortable, I'm not saying the Raiders are going to do this, but just in a vacuum, would you be comfortable drafting a guy like that at that sort of position with the fourth overall pick, or with the top five or top six pick? Or do you think just because, you know, inside linebackers don't really seem to be valued quite as much as maybe they were 20 years ago because of the move towards the spread and move towards, you know, more passing sets, would you be inclined to wait on them even if you think they're going to be a superstar, and maybe wait till the bottom of the top 10 or maybe even, you know, the teens of the NFL draft?
Yeah, I would definitely want to trade down. If the Raiders are really targeting one of those linebackers with their first pick, I would definitely consider trading down. But I think there's rumors that Tampa Bay is really interested in Devin White as well. Mm-hmm. So if he's there at five, he might be gone. But I like Bush better, and I think you could trade down to get him. But with this draft being so rich in strong defensive linemen, Quinton Williams or Ed Oliver might fall down to four. Mm-hmm. I think it just makes more sense to draft one of those guys, especially when you're considering positional value.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. You mentioned linebacker position for the Raiders. They signed Vontaze Burfict this offseason. Do you have any thoughts on Burfict and if he's still really a viable NFL linebacker and how he might fit within the Raiders?
If we're going just off his 2018 film when he did play, he just does look like a shell of his former self, made a lot of mistakes, looked slow, looked lazy. So he's signed to not much money, and they could cut him if they want. Obviously, Paul Gunther, defensive coordinator for the Raiders, who coached him in Cincinnati, pounded a table for him and really wanted to give him a shot. So I think this is a low-risk move for the Raiders, but I also think that the Raiders shouldn't count on him. The Raiders should try to add at the position, and if he turns out, he comes to camp, he's in shape, he's ready to go, then that, you see him as a bonus more than a guy that you're really relying on. And, you know, he's not a solution, I don't think, or they shouldn't look at him as a long-term solution.
So basically, if they do have a shot at grabbing a linebacker, not with four, maybe later in the draft, you think they should go and take that opportunity and just sort of, you know, if it's perfect, basically a bonus, if he ends up being a useful player?
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't count on him being a starter and playing 16 games well. I would try to add to the position, and if he somehow gets back to the level where he was playing in 2013, then just take it as a bonus, and now you have a good linebacker at a really cheap cost.
Yeah, that's true. So we talked about the Raiders. You mentioned that the Buccaneers could be interested in a linebacker. They lost Quan Alexander to the San Francisco 49ers this offseason. They have the second overall pick, and they are in a very interesting spot. They added Dee Ford, so they're not quite as desperate for an edge rusher as they might have been in years past. What do you think the Niners should be doing, and what do you think they're inclined to do with the second overall pick in this year's draft? Is it just, you know, take Nick Bosa if he's there and then just worry about the rest of the situation later, or should they be looking for something else?
I think that if they add Nick Bosa, they could all of a sudden turn edge rusher, which was a position of need for so long. If they pair Bosa with Ford, all of a sudden that edge rusher position becomes a position of strength, which they haven't had in a long time. And I think Quinton Williams and Nick Bosa are just on a tier on their own. in this draft. They're just that much better than all the mm-hmm. other prospects right now. And they have a lot of interior players. So when two players are graded around the same and one player is of a position of need, I think you draft that position of need. Mm-hmm. And I think edge rusher, yeah, they got better with Dee Ford, but they still need to add to that position. Mm-hmm. So I think Bosa just makes too much sense for them at two.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. In terms of their scheme, I've read stuff about the Niners possibly moving to more of a wide nine approach with their defensive ends. Do you buy if that's something they're really going to use as a defense quite frequently, or is it just going to be sort of for passing downs, or do you just not buy that at all?
Oh, no, I think they're definitely going to play more wide nine with the addition of their defensive line coach, who I can't remember their name right now, but he used a lot of wide nine, and I believe I saw some quotes about them talking about using a wide nine. Mm-hmm. So they're going to move to using it. I don't know if they're going to use it on base downs or if they're just going to use it on third down. I wouldn't be surprised if they just used it on third down. But it's definitely going to be a change the Niners will make.
Chris Kocurek, I believe, is their defensive line yeah. coach. I have to admit, I did not know that either. When I did look at the Niners staff, I did see that not only is Wes Welker on the staff, which I knew, but D'Amico Ryans and Miles Austin are both on the staff, so I feel mm-hmm. extremely old right now.
Yeah, when players that you were scouting and writing about for the draft turn out to be coaches, that's when you know you've been doing this a while.
Daniel Bullocks is on the staff. This is terrible, Ted. How can the Niners be allowed to do this? It's shameful.
Yeah, I don't know. But Ryan is actually a pretty bright coach. I've seen him coach, and I was pleasantly surprised by his ability to communicate. And, I think he's going to be a really good coach for the Niners.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the wide nine, I mean, you have Eagles fans who I'm sure remember Jim Washburn's time there ended up being a bit of a mess. Do you think that is a scheme that plays well in the modern NFL? Do you think it's something that people make a bigger deal out of perhaps than they should? Or how do you see the wide nine fitting into the Niners in 2019?
I think in today's NFL, for sure, the wide nine is more viable than it was before, just because of the rise of the passing game. Mm-hmm. There obviously there's going to be a weakness when it comes to the run game when you're lining up that wide and asking inside linebacker to cover that big of a gap in between the defensive tackle and defensive end. So, but with more passing, it's more viable with because you know obviously with the wide nine you're trying to rush the passer. Mm-hmm. So I think that yeah, in today's NFL it works better.
In terms of that Niners defensive line, of course, so much invested in that defensive line, years and years of first-round picks. Let's say they take Bosa at two. How do you see them lining up next year, and who's sort of going to be the odd man out?
Well, it would be Bosa and Ford on the outside. Obviously, DeForest Buckner is going to be starting,
yeah.
So that leaves Solomon Thomas and Eric Armstead kind of battling for playing time. Solomon Thomas improved last year, towards the end of last year. Mm-hmm. Armstead is just a really strong run defender, and he could push the pocket a little bit. So I think that'll be an interesting camp battle to watch out for. But I would think that the Niners would be more inclined to give Thomas more playing time because mm-hmm. of his development last year and the fact that he was drafted so high.
Do you think then they would consider trading Armstead, or do you think he's valuable to have around as sort of a, like you said, someone who can be a defensive tackle on rundowns and maybe even, you know, did he play outside of the last year as a defensive end?
Yeah, he did. He played a little bit outside. I think the Niners would want to keep him and have a strong rotation.
Makes sense. I mean, it's good enough for the Eagles, so you'd figure it might be good enough for the Niners as well. All right, Ted, well, of course, you are going to be covering the draft for The Athletic. How can people check out more of the great work you do there?
So you can follow me on Twitter at @FB_FilmAnalysis, and I have my own podcast, Coffee House Stunt. We talk about the draft and talk about the Raiders on there as well.
Awesome. Ted, thank you so much. We're going to come back with Bill Connolly of SB Nation in a moment here on The Bill Barnwell Show. All right, back here on The Bill Barnwell Show. I am Bill Barnwell at ESPN. That's still me. It's still, thankfully for now, my show. And I am joined at the moment by another Bill, someone who has written for Football Outsiders in years past alongside me, and then has written for SB Nation for several years now. The foremost college football writer, I would say, in America, someone who writes previews and isn't, I believe, in the middle of previewing each and every FBS, is that the right term? FCS? And I can't believe I didn't think of the term. As you can tell, I'm a college football expert. That's why I'm having another fellow college football expert on the show today. It is SB Nation's Bill Connolly. Bill, how are you?
I'm very good. How are you?
You can tell that I am extremely qualified to discuss
college
football.
You didn't read today's Air Force preview?
I did not read today's Air Force preview, but you know, I know that you just hate all the service academies. That's why I didn't read it.
That's right. My numbers are designed to hate the service academy.
It's a very strange choice you made, just to disrespect the troops by building into your algorithms, which are designed to be accurate in representing the future, that the service academies are actually bad. But I don't believe that is the case. You should read all of Bill's stuff on SB Nation. And there, if you're not a college football fan, you're going to learn a bunch in this conversation. But there's also a lot of draft preview stuff you've been writing for SB Nation that we're going to get to here in this conversation as well. But Bill, let me start with this. You are, if I'm not mistaken, a card-carrying member of college football Twitter. Is that fair to say?
I mean, yes, I would say that's very fair to say.
Very fair to say. Okay. Every year, I feel like there are players who make it into the first round of mock drafts and NFL drafts in reality as well. Players who make it in there who college football fans cannot possibly fathom as first round picks, just based on how they actually played in college football over the past few years. So let's start with this.
To say the least.
To say the least. Who are those players this year? And why do you think they are rising up draft boards?
Well, I mean, you start with tall quarterbacks. That's usually the first giveaway is, you know, once we get away from the actual games being played and into, you know, how far can you throw a ball into a bucket? You know, how good do you look with shorts on and whatnot? Then we start to see names moving up and down, and usually the quarterback position is the first. And I mean, you know, I don't want to, I feel bad. Like, I really enjoyed watching Daniel Jones play college football, or at least I did when he was doing really well. He had a few really, really good games. And if we're, you know, comparing this one to maybe other former prospects who got hyped to a level that college football fans didn't really understand, he had more really good games than Josh Allen did at Wyoming last year or the year before. I think people, you can kind of tell when college football Twitter, when random members of college football Twitter have started to try to jump into draft talk, because each one of them has at one point or another gone, wait, they're Daniel Jones is where? You know, they would have probably projected him as maybe getting drafted, based purely on his college football performance, but he is a likely first round pick, and it's kind of mind blowing.
Is it just the height, you think? Or, I mean, is there something else that makes you think, you know, with a small sample, or what about it? Daniel Jones makes him such a viable
player. Well, what's funny is, I mean, I'm comparing him with Josh Allen here, but it's a very different case in that. I mean, number one, he doesn't have, he can't throw the ball 400 yards on a rope. You know, he doesn't have, the arm strength might be his biggest issue right now, but I think, it's very clear that his head coach, David Cutcliffe, you know, still has a little bit of the Manning aura. He hasn't really produced any pro quarterbacks since the Mannings, or any at a particularly high level, I should say. But he looks the part when he's backing up to pass. You know, when he's surveying the field, he looks like he knows what he's doing. It's just, you know, his arm strength isn't amazing. His mobility is good, but he was extremely all or nothing, and he was all or nothing throughout his 3-year career. We have a pretty healthy sample on him. He was basically the starter from about the second game of the first game of his freshman year, early on. And the whole time it'd be, you know, torch this opponent, throw five interceptions in this game and look great for 2 weeks. And then, you know, the quarterback rating doesn't go over 100. The college pass rating doesn't go over 100 for a month. And it kind of continued that way this year. He looked phenomenal against Northwestern early in the year when they thumped what ended up being a division champion Northwestern team. He looked phenomenal against Pitt, throwing four touchdowns, no interceptions. He basically looked like Lamar Jackson against North Carolina, went for like 300 and 150 or something like that. And then he was terrible against Clemson, which is fine, but then he was terrible against Wake Forest as well. He had such an up-and-down career, and it was still ups and downs at the very end, but we are apparently, we're set on him being a first-round quarterback.
let me play devil's advocate here for a second. I'm not going to say I agree or disagree, but just in terms of trying to figure out what it might be besides just that he's tall and happens to have, you know, that Cutcliffe compare or coaching in the past and then happens to look like an NFL quarterback in terms of his size and shape. Did he have the best supporting cast at Duke? Would you say that he was playing against a slate of defenses that were better than the players he had around him on offense?
I would say he absolutely did not have an amazing supporting cast at Duke. I would also, however, say that the ACC was a dramatic disappointment this last year.
Sure.
Just overall, top to bottom. Worst power conference, according to my S&P Plus rankings, worst power conference. And I thought it was maybe going to be the second best, and it was the worst. Like, a bunch of teams disappointed. He faced, you know, a pretty good Northwestern defense and looked really, really good. He faced a great Miami defense in a monsoon, and that was kind of unfair. But then he also got lit up by Clemson, and Wake Forest had nothing resembling a good defense, and he got lit up there, too. So, I mean, in a lot of the games where he performed the worst, it was against opponents that you could say were pretty evenly matched. At the lower end of the quote-unquote talent pool within the ACC, those were some of his worst performances. So he absolutely didn't have an amazing supporting cast. He wasn't going against the SEC West either.
All right, Bill, well, let's talk about the rest of the college football draft class and the NFL draft in a moment. But first, let's talk about our friends at ZipRecruiter. And the NFL draft is pretty much a crapshoot. I'm not going to lie. Every bit of research I've done, every bit of analysis I've seen has basically said that the NFL teams don't really have a great idea of what they're doing. Well, you know where I'm going with this. I would recommend using ZipRecruiter because it's so hard to find qualified candidates for NFL jobs. It's probably hard to find candidates for the job you want to fill as well. ZipRecruiter makes that easy. And by going to ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell, which is my promo code, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. That's what ZipRecruiter does for you. They save you time. You don't have to hire a ton of scouts to post a job. You can just post it yourself and get qualified candidates for your job in just one day. 4 out of 5 employers. That is a much better rate than the NFL draft success rate. 4 out of 5 employers who post their jobs on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the very first day. And right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free, $0.00, at this exclusive web address. That is ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. My last name, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell, B-A-R-N-W-E-L-L, ZipRecruiter.com/Barnwell. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now back to the show. Is there someone else who you would say also fits into this group of inexplicably, perhaps, in the middle of the first round or towards the end of the first round in mock drafts and maybe likely to show up in that same space on Thursday?
This year, I think, has been better in terms of, you know, the talent, you know, the star power in college matching mm-hmm. the kind of your draft projections. There are guys, you know, DK Metcalf being maybe the top receiver being taken is a little strange just because he wasn't even when he was healthy, he wasn't even the number one receiver at Ole Miss. Mm-hmm. A.J. Brown was by far the go-to guy, and that was something I wrote about this morning, actually, about how, you know, in blitz down situations, in red zone situations, A.J. Brown was the guy Ole Miss went to. And when they went to DK Metcalf, he barely produced. He had the worst catch rate in blitz down situations of anybody in this year's prospect pool for the receiver position. So that's a little odd. You know, he makes up for it when you see him with his shirt off and when you see him running a, you know, 3.940 or whatever that was. Like, that starts, you start to understand it a little bit. But in terms of production versus, you know, draft stock, that one stands out a little bit. But I think overall, this is pretty good just because, I mean, there are a ton of really, really good defensive linemen and rush ends and edge rushers and whatnot in college football last year. And so you see the names at the top, whether you're talking about Bosa or Josh Allen or Quinnen Williams, all the way down through, you know, basically the 15 or 20. Cleveland Ferrell is going to go to a playoff team next year. And he was for large parts of the season, maybe Clemson's best defensive lineman. So you can find a lot of value as long as you're looking in the trenches this year. Otherwise, I don't know. Everybody needs a defensive lineman, though. So that's going to be my recommendation, is just everybody should pick a defensive lineman in the first round.
Everyone just 32 defensive linemen in the first round. That would be impressive. I would be intrigued if Kyler Murray fell to the second round of this year's draft because everyone took defensive linemen. But I suppose stranger things have happened.
I mean, that's fine. You know, a couple quarterbacks.
Well, in terms of the quarterback class, we talked about Daniel Jones. I'm assuming that you're not especially high on him. I think we can leave that there. In terms of what else you heard about the quarterbacks for SB Nation, is there a guy who you're higher on, perhaps, than it seems like the NFL is, and someone else who maybe outside of Daniel Jones you're not quite as high on as the NFL seems to be heading into Thursday's draft?
Yeah, what I've tried to do with college stats in general is, you know, one thing I figured out, especially with the quarterback position, mostly for the receiver and running back positions too, you know, we can't obviously come up with a specific formula that perfectly projects how you're going to perform at the next level. It'd be amazing if we could. But, you know, I tried to step back and try to figure out, like, what can we figure out? And I think one of the biggest things is, we know your ceiling. We know your statistical ceiling from college to pro, because especially at the quarterback position, nobody overachieves their college stats, their rate stats, you know, the adjusted yards per attempt or success rate or my marginal efficiency or things like that. You're not going to exceed what you produced in college at the pro level. And so at the very least, we can then assign ceilings to guys. And what I found for this year's quarterback class, and it's kind of right, Kyler Murray has by far the biggest ceiling, the highest ceiling of anybody in the draft. We see his potential downsides. He does improvise a lot. He does trust his legs a lot. He is short, you know, for whatever that actually means in the NFL in 2019. But his stats were unbelievable. And in so many ways, he almost exceeded Baker Mayfield's stats from last year. And Baker had produced stats that just about nobody else had. So right. His ceiling, I think I'm very comfortable saying, you know, the upside there is easily the best among the quarterbacks. Second is probably Dwayne Haskins. We don't really know how he handles pressure all that well. And he got the benefit of a lot of screen passes and whatnot. But again, we're talking ceilings only, and his stats were very good. The third, though, is kind of interesting. I mean, I'm a Missouri guy. I would love to see Drew Locke do well in the pros. But by far, from a ceiling perspective, from a stats perspective, Will Greer was easily the number three choice. And I've seen a lot of different evaluations of Greer, good and bad. And it's going to be kind of interesting to see not only where he goes, but, you know, if he lands in a situation where he is asked to play quickly, like, I'm really curious what that means and how ready he'll be.
Yeah, I mean, I it seems strange to me, given that you're incredibly biased towards Missouri, that you would disparage Drew Locke, and yet here we are. What is Drew Locke lacking?
Well, Drew Locke, I look at the career stats first, so I did have to make a little bit of an adjustment with Drew Locke's stats, simply because his freshman year was unfair. It was unfair to count his freshman year in the stats. Number one, because very few quarterbacks play their true freshman season. And number two, when they do, they're not tossed into the worst Missouri offense of the last 75 years. That had proven its general lack of quality before he got into the lineup. So that was tough. And if you remove his freshman stats from the equation, he's still behind Greer, but he's basically just behind Greer. And so, like, I feel comfortable having him in terms of ceiling and projection and whatnot. I feel comfortable saying that he's maybe the fourth on that list, but Greer's stats really were impressive. And I mean, Florida, the only time Florida had a pulse offensively from about 2011 to 2017 was about 3 weeks where Will Greer started playing well as a redshirt freshman before he ended up at West Virginia. So I get it. I understand the Drew Locke hype, and I back up a lot of it. He grew constantly over the course of 4 years. And I think he showed a ton last year with some of the injuries they were dealing with in the receiving core. But the people who are sticking up for Will Greer, I definitely understand that.
In terms of Drew Locke, in terms of those freshman stats, are you someone where you feel like, in general, across all quarterbacks, even if they don't have the worst offense for Missouri in 75 years around them, should we kind of just be throwing out those numbers or taking them with an enormous grain of salt, even if they're good?
Yeah, it is kind of – that was the one concern I had with using full career data the way I do. It is more accurate than just using last year's, or it projects better, but only a little bit better, because it does kind of depend on, you know, were you backing up on – well, were you Kyler Murray? Well, I guess that's not a great example, because he played a little bit as a true freshman at Texas A&M. But were you in a situation where you could sit back and absorb and watch a really good quarterback for a year or two and then step in? Or were you Drew Locke when you – came to campus, you threw like, I don't know, 8, 10, 12 passes in the first couple of games, and then the starting quarterback loses his mind and you end up in the starting lineup and they have to redesign the offense on the fly. You can't run the ball, you can't block, all these other things. That was an extreme example, but it does, when you use the full career stats, it really does kind of depend on, the bigger the sample, almost the worse it is, because it means we're counting stuff that happened really early in your career.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned the wide receiver class. You talked about DK Metcalf a bit. If he's not the number one wide receiver in this class to you, which it sounds like he's not, is it AJ Brown or his teammate Ole Miss, or is it someone else in that wide receiver class who you're particularly excited about?
Well, I really like AJ Brown. I think he's going to be, I think at college and the pro levels, you can still scheme guys open from the slot and tight end positions especially. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he is the masterful slot receiver. He could do other things, but he knows the slot. He knows how to play that position really well. And I think that's an opportunity. But you could also say that you can scheme the slot receivers open. So maybe his stats were a little inflated because he played the slot if you really want to. If we're talking about guys out wide, you know, I think the stats back up most of the hype for the top guys. Hollywood Brown, A.J. Brown, Terry McLaurin. N'Keal Harry, yes and no. He was kind of a mixed bag from a pure stat perspective. He's one of those, like, I've seen the scouting reports where, you know, he's not as good at getting separation, but he's also better than most at catching in traffic. Mm-hmm. I don't really know what that means when you're translating to the pros. I could see that going either way.
Sure.
But most of the top guys are top guys from a stat standpoint, too. The big example, or the big exception, I guess, being Metcalf. But I just want to see somebody. I'm a Missouri homer. I want to see somebody draft Emmanuel Hall instead of DK Metcalf, fix his faulty random injury problems that he has, and watch him become a major value in the third or fourth round.
Mm-hmm. And you also wrote about the running back class. The key player there, it seems like, is Josh Jacobs. Does he read out as an actual first round pick to you, or just are you so apprehensive about running backs that you wouldn't even take him in the first round?
Yeah, I struggle with him being a first rounder. I accept that he kind of broke the scale when it comes to efficiency. And the way I've kind of learned to look at the running back position, you know, you got to look at running efficiency and you've got to look at receiving efficiency to a certain degree. But explosiveness doesn't really translate from college to pro very well. That's where you start to look at combine stats like the broad jump and bench press. Those things translate a little bit when it comes to potential explosiveness. Josh Jacobs has none of that. He didn't really have a lot of explosiveness in his college stats, and then he didn't really do well with his combine or pro day measures either. And so, I don't see him being a Saquon Barkley home run hitter type, but he was the most efficient runner and the most efficient receiver in this class of running backs, and I think that will translate reasonably well. But, I mean, if you're drafting a guy in the first round, a running back in the first round, I think you kind of need to know there's some dramatic upside there, and I don't think he necessarily has that.
Is there a back in this class who you think is better than maybe his draft stock seems to indicate?
Yeah, I mean, I think, I get it with guys like Josh Jacobs and Damian Harris, but I'm really, really curious about, among others, I'm really curious about Darwin Thompson at Utah State. He kind of broke the stats last year. Now, he was in the Mountain West. It was a good Mountain West, but it was still a G5 conference. Wasn't the hardest competition, and he didn't really do amazingly well against Michigan State, although that was his first game, and he wasn't a starter yet. But his stats were amazing. His receiving ability was awesome, and then he did really, really well in terms of pro day production as well. Mm-hmm. He seems to have that all. He seems like a really, really nice sleeper that you, I think, could probably grab still in probably the fourth round or so, maybe lower. So I like that. I think he's got a nice, he's a really nice sleeper pick overall. In terms of, I was mentioning the upside and home run potential and all that. I don't really know. I think Rodney Anderson might have the most, he might be the most complete back in this draft. Mm-hmm. When it comes to run efficiency, reception efficiency, and explosiveness potential, but you have to ignore the injury history if you want to draft him, and that's going to make anybody queasy. So I understand why he might not be a first-round draft either, but in terms of potential, he might be the only one I'd be willing to take.
Is there a back who – we'll finish up here – a back who is pretty well-regarded as a second-round pick who you think mm-hmm. teams should not be quite as high on?
Well, David Montgomery is really, like I mentioned N'Keal Harry earlier with the, you know, lack of separation, but really good in traffic. Mm-hmm. Montgomery's the running back version of that in that, you know, he broke PFF's grades, right? He did so well. He was breaking, you know, one guy wasn't going to drag him down. He was breaking tackles on every single carry. He was just a load. And he really never gained more than 5 yards in a carry. So, like, what does that mean? How much can we put on the offensive line there? Because, I mean, obviously, Iowa State didn't have as much talent on the offensive line as other schools in the Big 12 did. But I worry, like, if he fails, if he doesn't live up to potential, it's a lack of athleticism that's going to hold him back. Like, it's great to be able to break tackles and whatnot, but the best backs are the ones that can run away from tacklers and not have to make a move or break a tackle at the line of scrimmage on every play. So I'm curious how he translates to the pros, because I mean I believe to a certain degree I trust the PFF grades quite a bit, but this is going to be a really good test of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Bill, do you have anything else coming on the draft before Thursday, or are you just managing to get by publishing a preview of college football teams every day?
Yeah, somehow. Well, you know, I'm not going to pretend the Mountain West is getting billions and billions of hits, but it is still priority number one, I think. No, I really like those. I wanted to knock out those position pieces, and I've got a live blog coming on Thursday, and I'll talk a lot about draft needs and all that, but that's until the draft starts.
And where can people check that out if they're so inclined?
SBNation.com. I think it's mostly on the front page now, but obviously you can also check out the Twitter. My Twitter handle, SBN_BillC, and you can catch everything there.
Awesome. Well, Bill, thank you so much. You should check all that stuff out. And thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you.
All right, guys. Thanks so much to my guests today, Bill Connolly of SB Nation, Ted Wynn of The Athletic, and it's draft week. And before heading to Nashville, Mina Kimes and Lenny, who happens to be the star of a new ESPN commercial, chat with Dominique Foxworth, I don't know him, about the needs and possible strategies of the teams in the top six, the Cards, Niners, Jets, Raiders, Bucks, and the New York Football Giants. And you can listen to that by checking out the Mina Kimes Show podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And we will have a show coming next week recapping everything that happens, probably more towards trades and more towards the top of the first round and what the big decisions that were made on Thursday. That's going to be coming up on this very show, the Bill Barnwell Show, next Monday. So thanks so much for listening, and more audio on the way.